You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
Hey, everyone. This is Mark Schaefer. Join me, Mitch Joel, Tom Webster, and so many others at this fall's Social Brand Forum in beautiful Iowa City, Iowa. Every person who attends will get a free copy of my new book, The Content Code. Learn more and register now at socialbrandforum.com. Can't wait to see you there.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? Today's guest is Ian Greenlee. Ian is the author of The Social Media Side Door, digital strategist at The Economist Group, marketing consultant, and speaker. Previously, he was the director of marketing at Olapik, and before that, senior manager of content and social strategy at Bizarre Voice. His words and ideas have been featured in Harvard Business Review, Ad Age, Digiday, U.S. News and World Report, Adweek, Mashable, CMO.com, eConsultancy, the Smithsonian Institution Archives, and in many other places, including the famous NASDAQ Marquee in Times Square. Ian, welcome to On Brand.
Thanks so much for having me. Happy to be here.
So what did I miss in all of that about who you are, what you do, and how you got here?
It's tough to say. I guess the background, I'm originally from the Bay Area. I lived in Austin, Texas for 11 years prior to moving to New York in January 2014. Now I'm happily here in Greenpoint, North Brooklyn. There's a lot, but in terms of professional experience, I've had maybe 20 jobs in my life, but we pretty much covered the marketing related ones.
Yeah, you know, you've, I think, got all of the very hip and trendy places covered in all of that. You've got Austin, the Bay Area, Brooklyn. I think we need to cut some Midwestern places into all of that as well.
Yes, my grandparents have that covered, but I do enjoy the Midwest and would like to visit more often.
Awesome. So I think it's always interesting to kind of ask too, you know, because I am someone that kind of wandered into branding and marketing and found it to be a kind of perfect fit with the kind of strange background that I brought to it. And I know that I'm always impressed because I usually find people that are a mix of those like me. I'm not literally like me, but my background was theater arts and psychology. But I think it ends up being a pretty good fit for toggling between the right and left brain sides of the marketing world. What brought you to a career in marketing?
Well, it was definitely a labyrinthine path.
You win on the word a day calendar there.
Yeah, I hope I pronounce it correctly.
I wouldn't know. We're going to go with it.
You know, I graduated from the University of Texas in December 2007. And, you know, shortly thereafter, the financial crisis hit. Mm. I was a government major that didn't plan on pursuing the traditional path into either politics or law. I actually had joined a co-ed pre-law fraternity and hated everyone in it. And
to all of them listening.
Yes, it was called Phi Alpha Delta. It was more about nepotism. So everyone kind of that I was in the group with had this career path in front of them that involved their father's or mother's law firm. And I don't hold that against them whatsoever, but I had nothing of the sort. And I imagined myself in three additional years of school with these kind of people. And I couldn't do it. So I just decided that at that point my major was graduating. I'm not going to switch majors in pursuit of my passion. Government was interesting to me. Government at UT is the equivalent of political science. I don't know why it's called government, but it was interesting enough to me. And, you know, by that time I'd really dug into the business world and figured out that a lot of leaders in the business world didn't major in business. And although maybe I would have preferred to have done so if I could start over again, I was happy with graduating from a great school in a great town with a good, you know, 4-year degree. So I did that. And like I said, financial crisis came in. The only white collar jobs I could find at the time were sales jobs. And I was really ill suited for them. I'm not exactly an extrovert in many ways, at least. And I'm, I'm very shy about kind of doggedly pursuing prospects and all these things that make salespeople great. So what I took to doing was actually using things like the emerging social media tools at our disposal to engage with prospects before I would give them a call. So for example, I had one job where I was selling real estate marketing tools to multifamily companies, which is like apartment buildings, and realtors and brokers throughout the US. And when I would first just cold call them per my boss's instructions, I was getting nowhere. Half of that was my inability, I'm sure. And then half of that was these people have their phone numbers listed by necessity because they need to get leads that way. It's just part of the realtor way of doing business. So they're constantly barraged by sales calls, I think probably more so than any other business because of that public nature of that phone number and those public email addresses that they have. So I was just, you know, one of maybe 10 people that had called them that day if it was a broker at a decent firm. And I would get short shrift. They would hang up almost immediately. Definitely was a blow to my ego. And I started to do these things where I found these real estate specific social communities. One was called Active Rain. I think it still exists. And I would blog. I knew I was good at writing. This was one of the few things I thought would kind of help me professionally at that point. And I blogged about how realtors can use technology, actually having no experience doing that, because I had actually started to get my real estate license, take the courses, but I never ended up finishing it. And I blogged about what I knew, which was the social and technology side, just because it was an interest of mine, more so than the real estate side. I was terrified of, you know, making kind of like a rookie mistake about how the MLS worked and all this stuff. And sure enough, it kind of became sticky content. And I figured out this formula with ActiveRain in particular, which kind of consistently allowed me to get into their daily newsletter to all, you know, 150,000 members. And once I figured that out, the leads came pouring in. But what I noticed moreover was that, hey, this is marketing. I didn't even really know that marketing was an interest or a skill set of mine before that. But that moment where I could call these people now and they would know who I was and actually engage with me, because I was the person that had written the blog post they read that really helped them figure out Twitter or whatever, or I had commented on their blog and they appreciated that. Now I was more three-dimensional in their mind. And that's the basis of everything I do in marketing, is this idea that, especially with B2B, there are so many more dimensions now that you can pursue to engage with someone and have a warm conversation over time. But most people still resort to these kind of one-dimensional methods whereby they're thinking on a channel-by-channel basis. They're thinking, you know, as they're of their the people they want to engage with as targets or prospects, even though I know I already used that word, but these industry terms have some kind of hidden weight, I think. And if you think of your market as a group of people and you think about how people would like to be engaged with, then social media makes perfect sense. So that was the launching point for my entree into marketing.
It almost sounds as though what you found was the social media side door.
Exactly. This was prior to the formulation of that idea in my mind. But when I sat down to write the, I don't even remember what you call it nowadays, the proposal, for my book, to send around to get an agent, I started to put these stories together that I had written about on my blog before and try to find the through line between them. And the through line was exactly what you said, the social media side door, which is a way to kind of happily exploit the changing nature of access and influence in the world today and use that to your advantage. And I had done so by kind of figuring out the code to get into that newsletter, by figuring out the way to warm up those conversations. I should mention, I hardly ever got hung up on again after that. And I generated a lot of business for my employer. So that was great. And after that, I was kind of hooked. I did take sales jobs after that, just because the economy was such that super experienced marketing people at the time were the only people that could get the jobs. They were the only people that were really in demand. And once the economy warmed up a little bit, I was able to get more marketing jobs and leverage the contacts that I had made through working in real estate marketing as stepping stones. And kind of my ultimate social media side door was to take a Facebook ad and actually do kind of a reverse help wanted ad, where I targeted the coolest employers in Austin, where I lived at the time. And I could do so by, there was a where they worked field. There was also the bio field. And at the time, that's where you put your role. If you had a big ego, you would say like, I'm chief marketing officer or whatever, because there was no field for that specifically on Facebook. Mm-hmm. So I could target by key terms in there. And what I found was when I did that, I pointed it to a page on my blog that had kind of like a concatenated resume, purpose built for that experience of clicking on the ad and having an attention span of 10 seconds to see who this person really is. I got tons of job interviews, tons of consulting offers, and I hadn't been in marketing too long at all before that, maybe 3 years. So this was this kind of magic bullet I had found, where you just try to find a social media opportunity that very few other people are taking advantage of. You think about technologies in a new way. In this case, I had thought about technologies that brands were using to target consumers, and think about how that same motion could be applied to something else entirely. So I used it as a job seeker, and it went incredibly well. And ultimately, Bizarre Voice saw that. And the funny thing is, I had been screened out for that exact job, social media manager, already. Like, I had a phone interview, my resume was too thin. But once they saw that, they saw, I guess, my ingenuity, my ambition, and they brought me in for another interview, and it went from there.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, you talk about exploiting those, I think what you said was the nature of access and influence, the changing nature of access and influence. You talk about that at the individual level. How are these changes, these shifts, impacting brands? How can they capitalize, exploit those changes as well, beyond the individual level?
So depending on the brand, this can be a threat or an opportunity. I think for most brands, it's a mix of both. But with this newfound ability to access any brand at any time, there's the perception that that's just the way it is. That's how it should be. So it means, staffing up your social media customer service team for all hours of the day, among many other things. But it really means being accessible purposely, being conversational through the media that your customers are choosing to operate within, and realizing that you've got an opportunity as a brand to access organically audiences that you would once have had to pay for exclusively. And that's changing already. You know, Facebook has monetized the crap out of themselves, so to speak. So it's very difficult to have organic access to Facebook fans, for instance. Twitter is trying to make their video go native, just like Facebook did. There are all these things happening, but I think the reality still remains that brands can access more people than ever before, but at the same time, they have more competition in doing so. So kind of my consulting practice is focused on figuring out ways to find social media side doors to access new and qualified audiences.
So when you talk about the threat and opportunity, the thropportunity for brands out there, you talked about being purposefully accessible. And that seems like something that a lot of brands would kind of nod along to and say, yep, we need to do that. But it seems like it also might be something a little bit hard to implement, hard to get their arms around. Do you think?
I've wondered this, and I have to disagree. We've got these brands doing incredible numbers voodoo with big data. We've got Target being able to figure out if someone's pregnant or not, although that was a big scandal. But that's the capacity that big brands have today, that kind of wizardry. And if you can't figure out how to, just going back to the same example, staff your customer service team around the globe 24/7, but you can figure out when someone's pregnant, I mean, based on the data from their subscriber details, that's a crazy mismatch to me. So I think it's more old ways of thinking about what brands are responsible for and what they should be doing, more so than kind of logistical operations or capacity issues.
So, you know, that was actually kind of grabbed my next question, because I was going to say, what are brands missing about access? And I'm hearing kind of the challenge may be kind of that legacy thinking in terms of, I liked what you said about what is a brand's job and what's not. Is that true? Are there other things that that brands are missing when it comes to access?
Definitely. I think they can't expect access parity. In other words, they have to be more open to access than consumers. It is a lopsided equation from the start, and that's okay. They have to be there for consumers, but consumers do not have to be there for them, because the one that's paying is the consumer. So that when the money enters the equation, I think the person or the entity receiving the money takes on the burden of access, and sometimes it is a burden. But most of the time, it's simply what customers expect. They expect more of it today. They expect more meaningful access. Sometimes that access is participatory, you know, giving them a say in I don't know, a new privacy policy that your company is rolling out or your new logo. Not always, but sometimes it's just being there when they're reaching out. And I think that one of the big misconceptions, especially if you and I both go to a lot of marketing conferences, we see these amazing speakers talk about these amazing campaigns and programs, these big wow moments and, you know, hidden camera footage of customers reacting to these serendipitous moments. That's all great. I would never throw shade at that, right? But but where you really win that battle of access is in the tiny moments that aren't, you know, no case study is going to be written about it. It's when you are there for a customer when they have a very specific need, or maybe they don't know what they want, but they know that they can reach out to you, or that you can reach out to them because you know something's going on, that you'll not rush them through the process. So this isn't just customer service necessarily, and that you'll be there for them in a meaningful way, but then also cut it out when they don't want you there anymore. I think that the idea of brands being like your friend, or that this idea of like customer intimacy, it's super creepy. And maybe I'm misunderstanding what people mean by it, but I think that most customers, most consumers want very limited doses of brands on their terms and their terms alone. And that does not include being a friend. That does not include hanging out with them on Snapchat. Maybe it works for a small subset of consumers, but if that's your definition of being innovative from a branding perspective, you're only affecting such a small percentage of the kind of first adopter consumers in your market, that the focus should really be on those tiny moments that aren't going to make the case studies.
Well, when you write and speak, a lot of times you talk about the consumer brand relationship and kind of pivoting off of that changing. And, you know, is it, you know, sometimes we go too far, this kind of touchy-feely, friendly thing. What is your best way of describing that to someone that is kind of stuck in the middle, that says, I don't know what this is? You know, it's not that touchy-feely thing. But how has that changed?
Are you talking about someone on the brand side or the consumer side?
Yeah, the brand side. If they say, okay, so if we're not supposed to be best friends, but we're kind of there all the time, How do we get our arms around this? What role do we have as a brand?
Well, that's what data is for, and that's what conversations are for. It's not a mystery if you ask your customers, if you find the data, if you really listen to them across all channels. That's not just like you have a social media listening team that uses Radian 6. I don't even know if that's still a thing, to find tweets about your brand. It's got to be like a whole program, and it can include anecdotal stuff. It can include, you know, huge data sets. But if you don't know what your customers want from you today, you're not looking hard enough. You're not accessing the right information, or maybe you're at the wrong company because you're unable to get, you know, members of your team on board. The data, the information is out there now about exactly what your customers want. You don't have to ask them directly in every case, but there's no excuse really anymore. I think this idea that we can't know is an artifact of a time when we really couldn't. That's why we relied on anecdotal evidence from focus groups. That's why we kind of relied on gut and intuition and more of the right brain side than the left brain. But now that stuff is all still valuable, but it needs to be paired with a very healthy left brain understanding of the world through data and analysis.
So when it comes to data, you know, we're you know, hearing about big data everywhere, and like you said, there's no excuse for not accessing it. But I think sometimes there's a disconnect there too. You talked about kind of the social team over here listening. And so many times, you know, big change comes from above. You know, that's what people week after week talk about here on the show. Is there a disconnect in where that listening, that kind of big data mining is happening, that it's maybe not getting back up the org chart, so to speak?
I don't think it's necessarily a disconnect in terms of kind of where, what you're listening to. I think it's more disconnect about having the data literacy to understand what that means, and then having the data literacy at other points in your organization to take action based on that data. So if you've got a data science team that's processing this big data, turning it into insights, now those people are very right brain oriented. That's just, you know, part of the role. They're not always great at translating that data into clear, actionable insights and saying, hey, marketing person, this is what you should do. And on the other end of that, marketing people historically are not great at communicating with data-oriented right-brain thinkers. I'm sorry, left-brain thinkers. They're traditionally right-brained, and myself included. So I think that universally, throughout an organization, it's on all of us to increase our data literacy. Data is more important than ever before, and even creatives like myself have the capacity to go out and learn something new. You know, when I talk to rooms, sometimes I ask how many people know the difference between mean, median, and mode. This is stuff we've all learned at some point, right? But it just, if it's not the kind of thing you're thinking about day to day as a marketer, it needs to be. And by the way, a lot of people say they know, but they don't. And that's okay. But this is an example of where we can't rely on our intuition and creativity anymore as marketers. We need to challenge our organizations to increase data literacy, the understanding and capacity to use data, and the notion that data has value. That's how I define data literacy across the board. And we need to challenge ourselves to do whatever it takes, take courses, do internal training, read books about statistics. We need to increase our internal data literacy so that we can really understand how to use the data to benefit the customer and the bottom line.
I love that you answered my kind of wandering question, which was basically the problem with big data, that we see it so much. It's great. It's this great, I mean, I sometimes think of it as a like a natural resource, but you have to mine it and refine it. You can't just take the big rock. And I love that you answered that with data literacy, because it made me, as a listener, as you were just talking, take off my podcast host hat and put on my college educator hat. Because I know here at the College of Business that I teach at here at the University of Iowa, we've been talking about a marketing analytics track, and that speaks exactly to data literacy. So if you were talking to someone on the curriculum development side, what are the three things that if we need to focus, kind of if we think of ourselves over on the collegiate side as putting out the product, what are the three things that we would need to focus on to do better on that data literacy front?
Well, that's a great question. And I'm really encouraged to hear that you're thinking about that in terms of curriculum. I think that this is one of the fundamental gaps that we have today. As someone that's been in several hiring positions interviewing candidates fresh from business school, they have a certain kind of data literacy, but it's a financial data literacy, exclusively almost. It's not really the kind that's going to help you in figuring out your customer. It might help you figure out how to profit from them, but not how to make them happy. And so we need this kind of more humanistic data literacy inculcated among graduates today. And I think, I mean, I would prefer that be across the board, not just in business school. Myself, I didn't go to business school, as I said. But hey, I'll take it if it's just at University of Iowa Business School. So let's see. Understand that this isn't just a vacuum, that data literacy is increasing on the consumer side as well. So this is not a nice to have anymore. It used to be. But consumers are starting to realize that their data has value. And they're going to start expecting that you've got a good answer for them when they ask, why should I give you more of my data? Every student of marketing, whether they're still in school or not, should be thinking about that and should be joining companies that have a good answer, or joining companies to help them develop an answer as to why customers should give you data. If you can't answer that, you are screwed or will be shortly. Because there's this dawning realization that, hey, this stuff has value and we're pretty much giving it away as consumers. Now, some of the more privacy-oriented people in that subset of data-literate consumers are going to say, okay, I'm going to back off. I'm going to update my privacy controls. I'm going to stop giving this stuff away for free. But the more enterprising consumers among that same cohort. I'm going to say, you know what? If this data has value, I'm going to start working with companies to figure out how I can get more value for the, from them in exchange. So that kind of mode of thinking is really interesting to me, and I think increasingly important. Let's see. I would also say that teaching this stuff in an abstract way is fine. That's the way that most universities approach most subjects. But we've got so much real-world data, real-world case studies, experiences about how brands are using data, about how consumers are thinking about data with all these surveys out there, that we can really put this thinking into practice while we're being educated. And I think that the more that universities become participatory in that sense, that they're helping answer these questions as they are educating, and research needs to be done about this stuff. It's not just a kind of a one-way megaphone where you're just kind of endowing these students with an understanding of data literacy. I think that they can help you innovate on it as well. And together you can help companies and consumers while you're still, you know, in the course.
I think all of us that are kind of representatives of the marketing brand, it's incumbent on us to kind of fix this expectation, because, you know, you talk about over there on, you know, in organizations as it stands today, we've got this data literacy problem. My fun story is I teach social media marketing, which is almost exclusively senior marketing majors. And as we're getting to know one another, I always have everybody go around and say, you know, name where you're from and why marketing? And you would be shocked, and we would all kind of have our collective head shake over the answer, over how often I get the answer that, well, I want to be in business, and I don't want to do as much math. And, yeah, it's like there's a rude awakening awaiting all of those people with that answer.
Yeah. I mean, they might be able to kind of take advantage of the last dying breath of data illiteracy among marketers and businesses. Good for them, I guess. But... pretty soon, it's going to become a requirement that you know at least the basics, that you don't have to have insights spoon-fed for you, that you can do some of the analysis yourself, that you can really figure out how to apply it to real-world situations to improve the overall experience for your customers and make more money as a business. And I think that increasingly, this is stuff that's going to be asked for in job descriptions. It's going to be a qualifying criterion during interviews. It should be tested in business school. It should be, you know, a mandatory requirement in ongoing education outside of the classroom when you're talking about like training programs at businesses. And there's just no excuse anymore, because I am, again, like the most hardcore right-brained person naturally. My parents literally named me Ian S. Greenlee because they thought it was a good writer's name. And they're both creatives. They're both creatives. And I thought that was my destiny. And in a sense, I am a creative, but I'm also learning that that is no impediment to developing the left brain. I really didn't think I had it in me, but somehow I've managed to start to understand data in a way that approaches a way that maybe like a data analyst or scientist thinks about it. Although I'm not saying that there's nothing that is just natural about it. I think some people have, I guess, a predilection towards data literacy and that kind of thinking. And some people have to learn it. I'm in the latter category. But I'm also not saying I'm anywhere near as data literate as, say, an economist or a data scientist. I'm just saying that we can all learn to think in the way that they think in general.
You know, I think the big takeaway, too, is that you said in your answer earlier, you talked about not just in business schools either. And I agree. And I think, you know, how did I end up able to synthesize what I can. And, you know, you kind of brings us full circle back to that kind of atypical path to marketing. And really, marketing success, I think, too, is that, like you said, you talked to so many people that didn't have that traditional path here. And I think, you know, you talk about the challenge in data literacy today, that right and left brain disconnect, that you've got this group of people that gets it, the left brainers, and the right brainers that need to make stuff out of it and do things with it, and that they don't always talk to each other as effectively. And I think that in a general sense, I ended up well served because, you know, I had this a double major focus on things left brain, on the psychology, behavioral, social science side of things, research, experiments, numbers, stats, and then the theater side that was this kind of right brain, creative, let's put on a show thing. And I think if you cross those two streams, you get something that can actually do what, quite accidentally, I did not know what this path would be, but it's something that I think can lead one to success in marketing, that kind of ambidextrous right and left brain thinking.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I don't know what I can really add to that. That's essentially what's going on. I mean, it's not in the curriculum yet, you know, in most places. It's not something that is going to be handed to you. You have to go out and seek it. In your case, maybe you lucked out by getting both sides of that. In my case, I had to kind of seek it out. But either way, it's important. So no matter how you get there, marketers that want to succeed, that don't have kind of, you know, an incredible resume under them already, are going to have to get there somehow. And, you know, I'm here to say that it's not as scary of a proposition. It's not daunting. And anyone can get to a level that they can succeed at. It's not, you know, not everyone's going to take to it naturally. But if you really apply yourself, in the same way that people are going out and, you know, going to Code Academy and learning to code, this is one of those things that if you work on it now, in the early stages of when I think data literacy is super important, you're really going to stand out because not many people are doing that. So not many people in marketing, at least, are doing that unless they're like on an analytics or demand gen team that, you know, something that naturally has to deal with data. So if you're like a designer or you're in PR and you also have, you know, a few courses, or even just have read a few books that help you get to, I guess, a moderately data literate place, you've got an incredible advantage and you should be talking about that constantly within your organization to make sure that you're getting to kind of flex that muscle when it's needed. And also when you're looking for new opportunities out there, that should be a focal point of the conversation in, you know, the sense that you're not just a regular PR person. You've got this incredible added capability set that most do not. That's going to be really appealing to the right employer.
So we talk about thinking, talk about, you know, the right, left side of the brain. One thought I want to make sure that we get to in our time here is talking a little bit about thought leadership. You know, we've talked about big data, kind of some of these other marketing buzzwords. What role in all of this does thought leadership play?
Well, just like brand, thought leadership is exclusively in the eye of the beholder. I've worked at companies before where we kind of think of thought leadership as a category of content. And that's just a term of convenience. So like white papers, for instance, we'd say, oh, that's thought leadership. But in truth, it wasn't unless we were leading people's thoughts, right? Unless we were, that content was influential and that the people seeing it started to consider us thought leaders. So, wow, I forgot. I thought I had a perfect answer to your question. Now I forgot it. I forgot your question.
No, well, I just, it was, you know, as we kind of wrap up, it was a kind of a hasty question, a big question for our last one. But I just said, in all of this, as we kind of come full circle, thinking about, you know, that social media side door and standing out and kind of exploiting the changing nature of things. You know, what role in all of that work does thought leadership play?
Okay, sure. Yeah, I remember now. So if thought leadership is in the eye of the beholder, and if you grant me that, then we can say that we need to be paying excruciatingly detailed attention to how our content is being received across the board, because that's the way to know if the beholders, so to speak, are thinking of us as thought leaders. It's not that complicated, even though I just said it in a tremendously complicated way. It's the data. It's the data literacy. It's the listening and the insights and the getting the insights to the right people on your team and working with the right partners. That is the way you tell if people are thinking of you as a thought leader and what they think of the content you're creating and the marketing programs that you're creating. That's the way you assess whether you're a thought leader. And that's the way you assess how to get to that place. Before, it was kind of spray and pray, shotgun approach. It was kind of, we'll just call ourselves thought leaders and you know, that'll convince most people. But the data is there to really challenge that question or support it, depending on what's really going on. And if you've got that data literacy and the tools to put it to work, then you can optimize your approach constantly and be sure that this stuff is worth doing in the way that you're doing it and improve it so that you really are becoming a leader in people's minds instead of just saying to the world, I'm a thought leader. There's nothing that drives me more crazy than people that like have stuff like that in their Twitter bio, that they're a thought leader. I mean, maybe they are, but I want to hear it from someone that thinks you're a thought leader, not you.
Yeah, because I think that happens a lot. Oh, I'm making thought leadership as such. We are thought leaders.
Exactly. it's the same kind of thing that happens when people say that they create viral, you know, content. I think some of those people are in a situation where they said it once and now they have to keep saying it. And it's unfortunate for them, or companies that have viral in their name, right? It's a promise that you just can't keep most of the time. And I think thought leadership is the same thing. It's rarer than we think. But when it works, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah. So as we really wrap things up after big sprawling answers, kick back a bit. What's a brand that's made you smile recently?
Okay, let's see. So I have to say the MTA here in New York, who runs the buses and the subways. It's not necessarily in 100% happy with them way, but I recently got, there's this, speaking of viral, a viral Kickstarter project that put together and republished the brand standards book that the MTA developed with a designer from Italy in the 70s, I believe. And before this book came out of brand standards for things like wayfinding and signage, it was anarchy underground in New York. Every station had their own rules for signage and how to explain to people where to go. They had their own kind of internal names for things. You know, on a map, the stop might be called one thing, but once you get there and the subway doors open, you look at the sign, it's called something completely different. When that standards guide was published, it changed that equation. And if you grant one thing to the MTA for all its faults, it's amazing how many trains are running per day and how consistent the experience of riding through the subway system is. And it's all because of that designer and his team that made those standards consistent across the board. Before that, it were these microcosms And if you weren't from New York, actually, if you weren't from that neighborhood, you could just not find a way around the city. So they changed everything with these standards. And now that I have this republished book, I look through it, then I take the train every day and I see how much it's affected the way it works. The consistency between, I keep focusing on signage. It is one part of it, but that's where you see it the most. The consistency between, you know, font placements. You start to realize as a kind of a consumer of this information that your eyes naturally go to the same place every time because you see these patterns where you see, okay, the arrow is going to be pointing this way and I should look for it on this part of the sign. Or every time I go to this stop, I'm going to see it being called this thing specifically. And I trust that when I look at the subway-wide map, I'm also going to see it called that same thing, instead of different things like it was before. So, yeah, we get mad at trains when they run late on, you know, on occasion. There's rats running around. It smells bad. But if you think about the volume of passengers it has and the feat that it took to standardize the way people move through the subway system, that was really epic. And it still is so powerful, even though it happened in the 70s. I don't know if that's the kind of example you were looking for, but that's what I've been thinking about lately in terms of brand.
Man, I have to confess, I didn't know how you were going to get from point A to point B there, speaking of transit. But that was an incredibly thoughtful answer. And no, I mean, it does... I think sometimes we, like you said, we go to all these great conferences and sometimes we hear all the great examples. But I'd say consistency of brand experience at something of that scale is absolutely worth a smile. Especially, it'd be worth a smile just to up the ratios since, like you said, it's an easy thing to complain about considering the tasks they have on their plate.
Yeah, one last thought on that. I said earlier that I wish I had said it this clearly, but your brand is really the tiny moments and not the big things that case studies are written about. And if you think about the MTA, just the subway example that I just gave, that's really what it's all about, right? You're rarely wowed by consistency, trains running on time, or being able to find your way from point A to point B where you've never been before. That's a tiny moment. That's a tiny slice of your life. But when you start to see that you can rely on the information in those stations and on those trains, it kind of fades into the background. And that's where the MTA brand is built, in that tiny moment. They're not doing any crazy stunts to wow you. Sometimes they add some cool art to a station, but that's about the extent of it. People you know, love to complain about the MTA, but gosh, it could be so much worse. And they really win you over in those tiny moments.
Well, those tiny moments are, there's no easy answer. Okay, let's go make some of those, because it is doing the work, and it's not always, like you said, it's not always the sexy stuff that makes it into a quick slide in a keynote or a case study somewhere, but it's all of that. It's the tiny moments. I love that.
Thank you.
Ian, where can folks go to learn more about you?
On Twitter, I am at BE3D, which stands for B3 Dimensional, because everyone wonders about that.
I was going to say, I had to ask the story. That's one of those handles. It's a conversation point.
Exactly. My website is iangreenlee.com. Greenlee is spelled green like the color, followed by L-E-I-G-H. You can tell I've rehearsed that because I say it every day to at least three people. Let's see. You know, go ahead and find me on LinkedIn. Not hard to do. And that's about all. I'm not really hanging out anywhere else but that.
Awesome. Well, we will connect folks with all of those over in our show notes. Ian, thanks for being on brand with us.
Really had a great time. Thanks so much for having me.
And before we go, I want to flip the microphone around a little bit to our listeners. And apparently we have some at social media listening company Cision. Big thanks to Stacey Miller and her team there for putting together a great list of 50 marketing and PR podcasts that you should be listening to, and including your own on-brand podcast right here with it, in very good company with folks like John Jantz, Duct Tape Marketing, Jay Baer, Content Pro, or Social Pros, Content Pros, Chris Brogan, pretty much everything that I listen to. And the couple that I don't listen to, I'm certainly going to start. But boy, what a lot of hard work, what a lot of great listening the smart folks at Cision did. I'm linking up to that list here in the show notes for this post, so be sure to go find it there. And as a reminder, if you heard something that you liked in this episode or another, have a question for any of our guests to answer, let us know over on Twitter using that hashtag OnBrandPodcast, and you may just hear your thoughts right here on the show. Reminder that you can find everything, show notes, links, and more over at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show there via iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, click that 5-star rating button, give us a rating, drop in a couple sentences, give us a review, help others find the show. And don't forget that this podcast is brought to you by our Brand Driven Digital event series, including the industry-leading Social Brand Forum. You can learn more and register now for the very best price over at branddrivendigital.com and socialbrandforum.com. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.